Steve?
I just want to follow up on a point that Neil made, and this also is relevant to the case that Howard presented, a patient who presents with what is initially thought, both by surgeons who may see the patient and the oncologist, a non-curative situation. And certainly a patient who presents with multiple sites of metastatic disease, liver, peritoneal, ovarian, as in your case, historically, we would have thought, okay, we're in a palliative mode here. Well, those days are gone. There now is a definite subset of patients who have the dramatic response who surgical treatment with curative intent becomes a possibility. And so I think that we need to get that message out to not become nihilistic and not become fatalistic in that patient population, because certainly data from a number of centers, and particularly it's been presented by Elias from France, that in the old days we thought, well, if a patient had extrahepatic disease, they weren't a candidate for surgical treatment of their liver metastases. That's no longer true. We do have patients who benefit and have anywhere from a 35 to 40% five-year survival after resection of not only their liver metastases, but small volume extrahepatic disease.
Welcome back to this special colorectal cancer think tank. Dr. Steve Curley reviewed the next set of ASCO papers evaluating the issue of hepatic resection of metastases.
I was asked to review three abstracts presented at the recent ASCO meeting. The first is an interim analysis of an EORTC intergroup study. And in this study, it's a randomized two-arm trial, 364 patients total had been randomized by July of 2004. And in this study, there was a resection-only arm for liver metastases from colorectal cancer. And then in 182 patients, the plan was for six cycles of chemotherapy before and six cycles after, so sort of a sandwich technique, so both neoadjuvant and adjuvant. And the primary endpoint for this trial was progression-free survival. Now, what was reported at ASCO was not really survival results. Essentially, what they showed is in the randomized trial, the demographics, the primary tumor characteristics, i.e. T stage, N stage, whether the patients had had any previous treatment as an adjuvant for their primary colorectal cancer was very same. Most of the patients in the chemotherapy arm were able to receive all six preoperative cycles. Almost a third required a dose reduction. Most of the patients in the chemotherapy arm and most in the surgery arm were resected. Again, the patients who were not resected, it was generally because there was a finding of extrahepatic disease, carcinomatosis, and in a few of the patients on the chemotherapy arm, they were not resected because they actually progressed during chemotherapy and on further imaging studies. Essentially, preoperative chemotherapy from this presentation was felt to be safe, although they didn't really present any data on specific toxicities. There was no mention of any postoperative chemotherapy toxicities in this patient population. It was just stated that they mostly did go on to receive it. Unfortunately, there was no data on surgical morbidity or mortality presented as part of this. There was no information on whether there was any change or difference between the two groups, whether there was any increase. It was reported, however, that in the chemotherapy arm, there was a median reduction of the sum of the measurements of the tumors from 45 millimeters to 30 millimeters. Unfortunately, they didn't break it down into how many patients had response versus stable disease versus progression. It was just reported that as a median, there tended to be a reduction. And survival data is expected, hopefully, by the end of this year or early next year. The next study I reviewed is feasibility of metastectomy in patients with BEV as a first-line treatment. Again, Lee had mentioned earlier there were several results presented from the BEAT study. He mentioned some of the other results earlier. Essentially, this was opened in June of 2004. They've already accrued a large number of these patients. This is being performed in several countries in North America, Europe, Australia. It was essentially allowed to design surgical treatment with 6 to 8 weeks off of bevacizumab. This particular portion of the BEAT study looked at 31 patients who underwent metastectomy while on chemotherapy. The key thing with the BEAT study is that patients are receiving a large number of different chemotherapeutic regimens with the bevacizumab. Essentially, it could have been FOLFOX, CAPOX, FOLFIRI. Median time off BEV before metastectomy was 54 days. And essentially, this is data, as Neil knows, Axel and Lee and I sent a letter to the editor to JCO about a year ago now, Lee, is that right? Essentially stating that based on what we know about the long circulating half-life of bevacizumab in these patients, all of us from the surgical side are tending to wait at least 6 weeks, if not 8 weeks, from a last dose of bevacizumab. Many of the neoadjuvant trials that include bevacizumab actually drop the BEV out for the last dose of chemotherapy so that patients may have received, for example, FOLFOX or CAPOX within 4 weeks, but their last dose of bevacizumab will have been 6 to 8 weeks before. In the patients who went to metastectomy, 17 patients had no residual disease, 5 had residual, and in 8 it was unreported. The median follow-up in these patients was 12.4 months. What was noted is there was no wound healing or bleeding complications. About a quarter of the patients had some complication after surgery. The only ones of particular interest was a gastric perforation in one and a portal vein thrombosis and a myocardial in one. Both of these are in patients who underwent liver resection. The gastric perforation is a bit strange. I've not heard of that one before. I'm personally interested in the portal vein thrombosis as a hepatobiliary surgeon, and I'd be interested to kind of follow this study and to get the input from other members of this panel. Anecdotally, I can tell you that in the last year, I've certainly seen an upswing in the incidence of portal vein thrombosis after liver resection in our own population, so we're looking at this very closely. So far, we've not had any fatal events from that. It tends to be non-occlusive thrombus, but we then anticoagulate the patients. And again, there's no data in this study on whether any of the patients required any operation within 6 weeks of their last Bev dose. So the suggestion is that you can do metastectomy in these patients with a reasonably low morbidity rate and no mortalities. Last study is neoadjuvant chemotherapy, including Bev in potentially curable metastatic colorectal cancer. And again, this was a pilot study. This is patients who received Zelox, or CAPOX is the other name, obviously, plus Bev. 6 cycles delivered preoperatively. Again, the Bev was dropped for the 6th cycle, and then metastectomy was performed 5 weeks after the last Bev dose. Only 12 patients were evaluable at the time of the ASCO presentation. It was noted that the Zelox dose was reduced in 75% of the patients, generally for more capecitabine-related toxicities, hand-foot syndrome, that type of thing. 11 of the 12 patients underwent a potentially curative resection. There were no bleeding complications, no hepatic dysfunction. They had only 2 complications they reported. One was a wound infection, and one was a bile leak from the cut edge of the liver. Again, that incidence, it's only 12 patients. It's hard to make much from that. In our own much larger series from MD Anderson, where we follow all these patients prospectively, we've got about a 3 or 4% incidence of bile leak from the cut edge of the liver after a major liver resection. Essentially, they stated they were able to then resume the chemotherapy 5 weeks after the liver resection in all 12 of these patients, and at least by CT criteria, hepatic regeneration was appropriate in all of the patients when they had repeat imaging after a liver resection. Unfortunately, the extent of liver resection was not described, so I don't know how much liver was actually resected, what volume of liver. There was also no real description of the quality of the liver in these patients who underwent resection, which I think is a little bit of a limitation in that from, again, the point of view of a hepatobiliary surgeon, I'm very interested in the type of liver I'm resecting. Do these patients have significant steatosis? Is there any incidence of non-alcoholic steatohepatitis? Again, we and others have now reported that steatohepatitis is, in fact, an independent risk factor for hepatic dysfunction after a resection, and that may be independent of chemotherapy. There are certainly other factors. The patient body habitus, their BMI is important, as is the presence of diabetes. So these are things that would be very helpful in terms of looking at these studies to really analyze the data, and unfortunately it was not included.
Thanks, Steve. I want to begin with Lee and ask, getting back to this issue of Bev and surgery, do we have data on people who have emergent surgery and are operated with recent Bev and what's seen?
Scappaticci published an article in Journal of Surgical Research about a year ago demonstrating that patients who were on the clinical trials who had emergent surgery had a 13.4% incidence of either postoperative bleeding or wound healing complications, as opposed to those patients who were on chemotherapy alone, where it was about 3 to 4%. So if you're acutely on bevacizumab, in other words, probably within a month, then you do have a higher risk of postoperative complications. What we don't know is when we do elective surgery. There are some folks from Europe, some of the abstracts we just discussed, who say that you could do surgery safely 5 weeks after the last dose of Bev. My argument against that, and that we have argued that you should wait anywhere from 60 to 80 days, is that why not? We talk about chemo-free intervals, and it's unlikely that in that three-week period of time, a patient who has received effective therapy is going to progress from resectable to unresectable. So I would err on the safe side, and as Steve mentioned, it's probably not a bad idea to discuss with your medical oncologist about giving chemotherapy without the biologic, because we don't know if cetuximab as another biologic, inhibits liver regeneration. And we have done some preclinical studies, and I correct myself from previous presentations, where we have shown, if we look careful enough, that anti-VEGF therapy can inhibit liver regeneration. And even though it's intuitive, it has never been shown before, because the mouse liver regenerates so rapidly that if you look anywhere past 3 days following liver regeneration, you won't see it. We're currently doing studies to see if anti-EGFR therapy inhibits liver regeneration, because we will probably run up against the same issue with Erbitux as neoadjuvant therapy.
Axel, and then Steve.
I would clearly endorse what Lee said. If a patient really progressed within this short chemotherapy-free interval, this patient was not a good candidate for liver resection with curative intent in the first place. So it's actually not only safer, but also more reasonable to really give patients a break. And 2 weeks later, or 3 or 4 weeks later, really doesn't matter. And I always try to, because patients are worried about this issue a lot, because patients say, you know, I'm on this successful therapy, and now you're changing it, I want to be cured, I want to have my liver metastasis resected. So, you know, it's safe, it's the right thing to do, so patients should not be worried. This is one of the education points we have to make.
Steve, and then Rich.
And I just want to concur with Axel completely and follow up with what Lee said. You know, in a very large group of patients, I can honestly say we have never seen a single patient in a 6 to even as long as 12 week treatment break have significant progression if they have been responding, even if they've had stable disease. So we don't go in and operate on somebody who had a scan that said this was resectable. If we find anything that makes them unresectable, it is either, again, the presence of carcinomatosis that simply was not imaged on any study, and we then are able to talk about other treatment options in that group of patients. I do want to make just one other point, and I would love to get some other input, because this is a common problem. Axel, I think it was, mentioned the fact that patient received a PET scan, or perhaps it was Howard's case, and you know had a good response, and then the PET was negative. What we're finding is PET is worthless in these patients who are on significant chemotherapy, and it is not doing a good job predicting whether or not they have viable tumor in the liver or extrahepatic disease. We're seeing many of the patients who have had response or stable disease whose tumors are simply no longer FDG avid while they're still on treatment. So I would love to hear what people are thinking about whether PET should be used or whether PET is even useful in these patients who are having response to therapy.
Actually, in that case, there was more uptake by PET than they found viable tumor. But in my last discussion with our people, that this issue of the tumor being stunned, they call it stunning, so that it's not taking up glucose anymore, they don't have any data on how long you have to wait.
Rich, and then Dan.
I wanted to ask Steve, is resection of a liver that's pathologically uninvolved with cancer by the time the pathologist is done with it, is that a success or a surgical failure? And do you have any data from the large series of patients that you've operated on at MD Anderson to know how those patients do, the patients that you resect that don't have any viable tumor in the resection specimen?
The answer is I don't have any data yet. We will ultimately. We're obviously following all these patients prospectively. It's only been in the last 3 to 4 years that we've had a scenario where we go in and resect. And again, some of these patients do have radiographic abnormalities, i.e. they may have calcified tumors or they may have something I can detect with intraoperative ultrasound. We resect it, and then the pathology report comes back. It's a path CR. It's simply fibrosis, calcification of a completely treated tumor. I don't yet know if that corresponds with data from other tumor sites where a path CR correlates with a better prognosis. It is such a small subset of patients. Of the patients who we've operated on who've had a major response, what we find is similar to Howard's case. In the majority of them, they may have 80, 90, even 95% of the tumor is non-viable, but there will still be microscopic foci of viable disease. So we really have to look at that group who have also a major response but not a path CR and see what their prognosis will be. All of that is being followed by several of us who have large prospective databases, but I don't have any data yet on what that means.
Dan, and then Lee.
Two comments. One, to go back to the PET issue, is I think the only role for PET is at the initial characterization of the patient to assess for extrahepatic disease. But after that, I think PET scans are useless, and they really don't change
and
your therapy
and
shouldn't be ordered. From the standpoint of lesions that appear in clinical complete response, I think there was data presented at ASCO this year where a group, I think it was from France, looked at a per-lesion path CR rate, and it was less than 5%, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And in areas where they did not elect to resect, where there had been a lesion before, virtually every one of those became clinically evident for a fair...
Over 80%.
So I think what it says is to tell someone that a clean liver radiographically is not likely to result in cure in the vast, vast majority of patients without a surgical approach at both radiologically involved and previously involved areas.
Right, and that's why we are still taking an aggressive approach surgically in those patients. If a patient, say, had 5 lesions in their right lobe and only 2 are still evident, I still do a right hepatectomy on that patient because I know there was disease there before. The trickier patient population is those who had bilobar disease and now have disease that is perhaps unilobar, and I resect and I can't detect anything in the contralateral lobe ultrasonographically. So what I tell those patients is get used to me because I'm probably going to be back in your liver. And what I then do is I'll lay essentially Seprafilm other substances around that liver to cut down on adhesion formation. And I will tell them there's a very high probability that your subclinical disease will become clinically evident in a few months, and then we'll go back and deal with it.
Lee? So the abstract that Dan was referring to is from Bernard Norlinger, who looked at 66 lesions. So this was a lesion-based evaluation that disappeared with chemotherapy. It wasn't truly neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And of those 66 lesions, 55% of those clearly were not cured. Some of those lesions, there was microscopic disease after hepatic resection. Some of the areas where you had resection, you had recurrence at the resected margin. So one of the pleas that Rene Adam discussed in his discussion following this paper is that do not treat patients until you have a complete response if they are to go to liver resection, because we don't know what to resect or what to ablate. So even though it feels good to get a complete response, you should stop your chemotherapy before you get there, allow the surgeon to do resection or ablation, and then consider adjuvant chemotherapy afterwards.
Yeah, we don't know that that's a good strategy.
No, we have no idea.
It's naive to think that we'll know when and if we'll get a complete response in any patient.
I'd like to maybe put a little clinical perspective on this discussion. From our point of view as a CME group, this is one of the most important objectives that we have because it's changed in the last few years. My question to you is, to what extent are you seeing this penetrate into the community setting? Are you seeing more referrals for a curative approach? And also, another question that I hear from oncologists is, you have your patient, 35-year-old gynecologist that you want to treat for cure. What exactly is the regimen? Would you go with FOLFOX, Bev, cetuximab? What's your regimen in that situation? Axel?
I think right now when we talk about what's the best neoadjuvant strategy, first of all, based on the MD Anderson data, I would now say it's FOLFOX and not FOLFIRI. I mean, this is one of the questions that we always had, but I think the data are kind of reiterate what we have seen before, that we like to use FOLFOX. So the question is now, how do these biologics come into play? That's the next question. And all data that we see, and perhaps even the CLGB 8203 trial, shows that cetuximab addition to chemotherapy increases response rates. So if we're looking at a neoadjuvant strategy, cetuximab increased response rate, which is what we need in the neoadjuvant setting. We have another regimen which had impressive response rate, which was FOLFOXIRI. Again, the irinotecan toxicity might prohibit us using it. On the other hand, the data FOLFOXIRI were impressive, 61% response rates. Thirdly, how does bevacizumab come into play? Should we add bevacizumab to cetuximab and FOLFOX, or should we say we add cetuximab to FOLFOX plus bevacizumab and use everything we have in terms of biologics right up front? And it might make sense, and this is what we'll have to wait on if you look at clinical trial validation from 8405 or the PACE trial with panitumumab. If it was me personally and I had a curative chance, I'd probably be more aggressive and use effective chemotherapy plus dual antibody therapy, even outside of a clinical trial.
Which effect of FOLFOXIRI?
Probably FOLFOX based on the irinotecan data from MD Anderson.
Plus two biologics.
Two biologics,
on the side.
Yeah.
Dan?
I think the other message that needs to be reemphasized is the duration of treatment before you send the patient to the surgeon. I think the duration of treatment should be zero. That is, the patient should see the surgeon before you start your chemotherapy so they're involved in the approach. But I think the one thing we've learned independent of your choice of drugs is that people should not be treated beyond 6 cycles or more so that you don't run into the problems you alluded to, which is the steatosis and other chemotherapy-related complications.
We don't have the data that there's steatosis with Axel. Platin, right?
Well, I think it's been seen with 5-FU alone. It's been seen with every combination chemotherapy. It's native to treatment, per se.
Parenteral nutrition.
So
yeah,
that's why
parenteral
I think,
nutrition, for sure.
That's why I think the surgeon needs to be involved up front in the decision-making, if possible, but also whatever treatment you choose, intensive or not, I think that people should not be referred after 15 months of therapy.
Well, 15 months might be a little long, but I don't think you can make an arbitrary cutoff of 3 months.
I'm not making it arbitrary. I just threw out a number.
There's another trial that was presented, ASCO, Optimox 1. In Optimox 1 analysis, Amory's group showed that patients who went to surgery did not benefit for more than 3 months of therapy. So it's difficult because you can think these are different groups of patient, different characteristics of patient. But his message was, okay, 3 months of therapy is probably all we need to show that this patient is chemo-responsive. Because I think this is one of the ideas we also want to do with neoadjuvant therapy. We want to establish that tumors respond to chemotherapy. It's a prognostic indicator.
But ultimately, do we know that preoperative therapy in a resectable patient necessarily improves outcome?
No.
Not yet.
I mean,
no,
we're working off of this premise, aren't we?
Not yet.
So I think there's things we need to separate. One is neoadjuvant therapy, where you have a patient who's resectable de novo and somebody who is converted from unresectable to resectable,
two entirely different
groups of patients.
Right.
Yes, they are.
Exactly.
How do you make the decision about whether to use neoadjuvant therapy in a resectable situation up front or just go right to surgery?
I believe we ought to go right to surgery in those patients. There's nothing more effective than surgical debulking, and then you're treating micrometastatic disease.
Outside of a clinical trial, I disagree.
I completely disagree. Because, you know, one of the things we have in a kind of resectable patients population where we use chemotherapy, we can actually follow the effect of chemotherapy. And I have done both. If a patient, for instance, comes to me 2 years after the primary tumor was resected, stage 3 disease, 1 out of 10 lymph nodes positive initially, or 1 out of 15 lymph nodes to be correct, and has a relapse after 2 years, long delay until the metastasis showed up, it's single metastasis, solitary metastasis, I have no problem sending this patient to resection. If a patient had, like a patient that I saw yesterday, 25 out of 45 lymph nodes positive with synchronous metastasis, a 28-year-old patient, and has 3 lesions, small lesions in 2 lobes, which are considered resectable, but I feel more comfortable giving this patient chemotherapy up front than resection.
Steve, and then Charlie?
Well, I just, again, want to reiterate what Dan said, which is to get the surgeons involved up front. And while certainly surgical resection is the optimal treatment for these patients, I do support putting them on trials. There's a SWOG trial open right now looking at neoadjuvant, adjuvant. I think the reason it's important to get a surgeon involved, there are certainly patients who present who, at the time of presentation, have resectable disease, but it's borderline resectable.
That's a different situation.
Right. And if they were to be then that group of patients who actually progressed on chemotherapy, you could lose your window. And I unfortunately have seen that phenomenon where somebody has simply decided to give, with really no data as suggested, well, gee, let's go ahead and give you a few cycles of chemotherapy, then we'll refer you to the surgeon. And they come down to us, and you look at the scans before and after, you go, we've got a problem. We can't do anything with this. So very important to get surgical input up front.
Charlie?
I agree with Jordan that principal evidence to give neoadjuvant therapy in our current state of knowledge is to weed out those patients who shouldn't go to resection. The problem is, if you're going to really weed them out, you should be doing nothing for 2 or 3 months, which obviously we're not comfortable doing, because giving them chemotherapy, are we going to effectively know who we should weed out if they have stable disease or a response?
That's the UK approach. They do that.
Right.
Or they did that, at least.
Yeah. Lee?
So Rene Adam published a paper a few years ago showing that with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, if patients progressed, they had a much worse outcome. However, it was not a 0% 5-year survival rate. It was a 9% 5-year survival rate. So if they progress and they're still resectable, they should still undergo resection. But you know that their outcome is not going to be as good as that patient who had either stable disease or had regression of disease.
Right, but Steve's point is that you could lose the window by delaying, and somebody who might have been resectable with that approach become something otherwise.
I agree 100%. And that patient who is marginally resectable, that patient needs to go directly to surgery. And the patient who still has a little bit of room to grow, God forbid, just in case there's a 20% increase in the size of the tumor, that's a patient who on trial can receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy.
I'm just kind of interested in this idea of FOLFOX, a double antibody therapy. And I'd like to know if all of you are doing that or when you do that. It's interesting.
Throw in panitumumab as well. Why stop at 2?
No, there are better data for throwing in erlotinib as well.
But. Neil?
There's this unspoken truth hovering around here in this discussion of neoadjuvant therapy for hepatic metastasis. And that is a nagging belief, unencumbered by data, perhaps, that we can actually sterilize metastatic disease in the liver. The implication of sending somebody to the operating room who had 18 metastases, who now has 2, I've done it. Others around the table might fess up to this.
I've
the
done
data
it.
That although 80% of those radiographically normal liver biopsies have viable tumor in them, there is a percentage that does not. The data from 9741 that some patients with metastatic disease who achieved a complete response remain free of disease just with chemotherapy over a long period of time. So with our active therapies that we have now, the active systemic therapies, it may be that you can sterilize small metastatic deposits in the liver, and that sending patients to surgery who had disease that on the face of it was widespread systemic disease in the liver, confined to liver radiographically, but who have just a couple of radiographic findings that can be resected now may still be a reasonable approach. And we don't have the follow-up data to know what we're doing for those patients in the long term.
But I think that the data ultimately would be that those things that are radiographically visible, the likelihood that we're going to sterilize those lesions is small. And I personally don't believe that those patients ultimately are going to be cured. Those lesions will be cured by chemotherapy alone. Yes, there's probably a finite, extremely small number where that happens, but not enough that I think we should have that discussion with a patient.
Dan?
I was just going to expand on what Charlie said. I brought up the Norlinger abstract because of this nagging belief, as you said, that we are sterilizing radiographically visible lesions. I think we're doing a very good job of bulk reducing them in a non-surgical fashion. But I also think that as small as it is, the Norlinger data would support the fact that we are not sterilizing the vast majority. What we are doing, perhaps, is what we've done in adjuvant therapy for a long time, which is sterilizing microscopic disease, which is the other part of cure. So I think there may be more roles for staged operations, as Steve alluded to, where you have to literally go back and get the ones that regrow after you've done too good a job. And this extends to pulmonary metastases. The worst thing is to treat people neoadjuvantly with pulmonary metastases, because it's one thing to take out the right lobe of the liver because there was tumor there. It's another to tell our chief of thoracic surgery to take out an entire right lung and guess where the tumor was, because there's no intraoperative ultrasound technique that I know of, for example, for the lung, and feeling for what used to be metastasis, I don't think, not being a surgeon, is an easy thing to do.
Again, it goes along with data that several of us have, which is resection of more than one side of disease is not contraindicated. If patient has, say, both resectable pulmonary and liver metastases, we'll go after them, oftentimes at the same setting, sometimes as a staged procedure. Again, particularly in a patient who has shown response to therapy. And there is suggestion that those patients have a survival benefit. Again, out of both Elias and René Adam, both out of France, both have about a 30 to 35% five-year survival in patients who have two or three sites of metastatic disease from colorectal cancer that can be completely resected. The only variable that was important was complete resection, that you have to get an R0 resection, negative margins. Those patients can have a good outcome.
And so your approach in the lung is essentially the same in terms of the amount of lung tissue removed?
Yeah, we still just go after, make sure we get a negative margin. Again, the point that Dan brings up, if you can't see the lesion in the lung anymore and you can't feel it, then you don't know where to go. I mean, certainly I don't know of any thoracic surgeon who would do a pneumonectomy for two or three sites that have disappeared. They would essentially follow that patient and make them have radiographically detectable disease before they would go back after them.
Final comment from Neil?
I'd like to say something provocative. I think where this discussion is leading is that we are sending patients to the operating room for debulking surgery. Because if we say that the radiographically normal areas of liver now still harbor disease, but that the surgeon will not be able to resect them because they can't identify them, then by sending that individual to the OR to resect the radiographically visible disease, we're acknowledging that that, in essence, is a debulking procedure. And this is a real paradigm shift for us, because the morbidity of surgery now has gotten low enough, and it's so much more active than chemotherapy, that it's rivaling chemotherapy for the patient that we would have never sent to surgery in the past.